Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
The Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. Tonight might be Halloween, but there ain't nothing scary about the amount of sports betting action happening at the moment. The latest odds on NFL, NHL, MMA, and World Series are yours for the taking. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code Podcast1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a Podcast1.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Hey, welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Every week, we are bringing out some of the most requested episodes of the podcast from behind the archives. We have another great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
Happy Halloween, everybody, and welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. It is producer Sean bringing you the most frightening episode I could find in the archives. And I don't think I did a good job because it's got nothing to do with scary stuff. But it does have the word bone in it. Episode number 323, The Bone Collector, Michael Waddell. Original air date, May 10th, 2016. Michael Waddell is a well-known personality in the hunting world. Currently has a show on the Outdoor Channel with his reality show, Booger Bottom USA. And he's known very much for his pursuit of wild turkey, not the booze, but the animal, out in the wilderness, amongst other things. And him and Steve get together to talk about some hunting, of course. Michael's experiences hunting with his heroes, such as Dale Earnhardt Sr. And there's even some turkey trivia in here. And some homemade moonshine discussion that you guys are going to dig. I really tried to find something creepy, and I don't know. Steve hasn't talked to The Undertaker yet. If I had that, if he talked to The Undertaker, I would have played that. But I saw The Bone Collector, and I figured this would suffice. So there you go. Happy Halloween, everybody. This day in Steve Austin history, today being October 31st, that is Halloween, we start off in 1991 in Phoenix, Arizona. Dustin Rhodes fought WCW TV champion Stunning Steve Austin to a draw, and this show was a free show as a part of the Arizona State Fair. Then we go to 1992 in Chicago, Illinois. Steve Austin defeated Brad Armstrong, and tickets for kids were just 66 cents. So if you had nothing to do on a Halloween and you were in Chicago in 1992, you could take your kids to see this for cheap. Then we go to 1993 in Atlanta, Georgia, center stage for a WCW main event airing where Steve Austin defeated Jason Johnson. Then we jump to the WWF in 1998 in San Antonio, Texas. It is Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating Kane, Mankind, and The Undertaker in a four-way dance. We hop over to 2000 in Rochester, New York for a WWF SmackDown taping. This featured a in-ring promo from The Rock where he asked Steve Austin to come out so he could face-to-face tell Stone Cold that he had nothing to do with running him over a year prior at Survivor Series 1999. Steve Austin came to the ring and said, DTA, I only trust myself. Then Rikishi showed up and said, well, The Rock told me to do it because his merchandise sales were dropping. He did it for The Rock. And Rock was like, nah, man, I don't do that stuff. I do it face-to-face. And Steve Austin was like, DTA. He jumped The Rock from behind and hit a stunner. Then later in the night, The Rock defeated WWF World Champion Kurt Angle via DQ. After the match, The Rock was being double-teamed by Kurt Angle and Rikishi until Steve Austin came out, knocked Rikishi out of the ring, and then hit a stunner on Angle. Just for some payback, The Rock hit a rock bottom on Steve Austin for the stunner he received earlier. And then we wrap it all up in 2005 in Anaheim, California for WWF Raw. It featured Jonathan Coachman dressed as Steve Austin, see, because it's Halloween. And he came out and he was calling Steve Austin out and was like, look, Come on out, Steve Austin. I've got Gold Dust in my corner for Taboo Tuesday coming up this weekend, and you're going to be in some trouble. So says Jonathan Coachman, dressed as Steve Austin. And then Vince McMahon came out and said Austin was involved in an accident over the weekend, would not be at Raw or Taboo Tuesday, and declared Jonathan Coachman as the winner via forfeit. But all this ultimately did lead to Jonathan Coachman wrestling Batista at Taboo Tuesday, and that also had Goldust in Coach's Corner, as well as Vader. Vader was there too, randomly. So that's how that all ended up. Steve was not involved in that particular pay-per-view. But that is your day in Steve Austin history for today, October 31st, Halloween. And as always, I get my information from the history of WWE.com. All right, folks, thanks for listening to the Steve Austin Show and the Steve Austin Show Classics. Check out Tuesday's show, where Steve talks with the former Marvelous Mark Marrow, or Wildman Mark Marrow, if you're post-New Generation like I am. He is talking with Mark Marrow about a whole bunch of things, including wrestling and redemption in life. So make sure you guys check that out. But stick around, folks. Coming up after the break, we have Michael Waddell, the Bone Collector, here on a classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Happy Halloween, everybody.
Sports betting scene right now is off the chain with the NFL, NBA, and NHL seasons in full swing, along with the World Series in progress. We've even got some great sports betting action happening on a college football gridiron. Here's what's going down this weekend. University of Georgia taking on Florida. Virginia Tech squaring off against Notre Dame. Oregon versus USC. And the big bout in the Sunshine State between Miami against Florida State. Visit our good friends and exclusive partners of Podcast One, BetOnline.ag, to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up today for a free account at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1. Again, that's BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
And now, a word from Martellus Bennett, a professor at the Dos Equis College Football College.
Hey, college football fans, Martellus Bennett here. Do you want to win every football argument this season? Dominate every debate? Become a pigskin prodigy? Then enroll in a Dos Equis College Football College, where you'll learn from football insiders like me, Jay Cutler, Katie Nolan, and author John Bacon, the man who wrote the book on college football. So be the first in your family to earn a football watching certificate from a beer school. Enroll in Dos Equis College Football College at dosequis.com/edu.
Enjoy Dos Equis responsibly. Imported by Cervezas Mexicanas, White Plains, New York. Copyright 2019 Dos Equis Beer Brands. Official beer sponsor of the college football playoff.
Finally, there's a football beer school for me. Thanks, Martellus.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Coming to you from Marina Del Rey, California, down there right outside Columbus, Georgia. How you doing today? And before we get started, happy belated birthday, you old crustacean. You just turned 43 years old.
Brother, I'm telling you, I'm starting to feel it, man. I'm feeling like I come off the top rope a few times myself.
At least you ain't had no turkeys chasing you with steel chairs out there, though.
You ain't lying. You ain't lying. And if I did, at least I'd have a 12-gauge to fight them off, man. Y'all just have to have your muscle and your wit to figure out how to avoid them.
Hey, man. Michael, I'm on the OutdoorChannel.com website. And here's a little summary of you. And I've already talked about you in the open of the show. But it says here, if only one person could be chosen as the face of the modern hunting industry, that person would likely be Michael Waddell. A veritable superstar in the outdoor world, Michael combines his hunting expertise with his easygoing personality and entertains fans of all ages across the country. Pretty good write-up. And here's the thing. You and I ran across each other, and we've seen each other in the past, just passing by here and there. But out there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, at the Great American Outdoor Show, I was sitting there at a table there in a restaurant waiting on a flight, and there you was too. And I think if you'll remember, I was drinking a Bloody Mary for breakfast, and we hooked up and had a conversation. And I said, hey, man, I'd love to have you on the podcast sometime and just talk about hunting. So we exchanged information, and all this time it went by, and you shot me a text the other day about doing a podcast, and I said, man, outstanding. So it's good to have you on the show. And I want to talk about hunting, and I want to talk about strategies and setups. And it's turkey season, and I've never really done a whole lot of turkey season. So we'll talk about all things. And let's don't just talk about putting animals down, but I want to talk about just getting in the outdoors. Because, Michael, real quickly, my story with hunting is this. I was born in 64 in Austin, Texas. And I had two brothers, and my mother got a divorce, and she moved us down to Victoria. So we were city slickers in Austin. And then she married Ken Williams, my stepdad, who I refer to as my dad. Well, my father was born in 1935. Michael, everybody that was born in 1935 that lived in a rural outdoor, you know, country area grew up hunting. And so our stepfather, who I consider my dad, got us boys out there, and I'll never forget my first hunting trip. I was probably 7, 8 years old. And I remember my dad walking through the woods with a rifle in his hand, and my brother Scott, who's 2 years older than me, was in front. And then there was me, and there was Kevin behind us, wrapping up the trail. He's a year younger than me. Michael, we stepped on every twig, stick, leaf, and I will always remember my father constantly turning around with his hand up to his mouth, be quiet. So, dude, that was over 40 years ago. And every year, therefore, for a while while I was wrestling in WCW, I got out of the hunting because I was too busy being on the road. I got reintroduced to it to Paul Orndorff. But I know you grew up right outside of Columbus, Georgia. Pretty much almost the same story. How'd you fall into the hunting world? And because it become a passion of yours that you've turned into a lifetime, that you've turned into a job.
Well, it's kind of like one of these things. First of all, Steve, let me tell you, of course, being able to be on this podcast means a lot to me because, first of all, I grew up chicken as a dadgum country, as cornbread, as a chicken coop, pretty much. And so, anyway, with that said, man, there ain't no way you can live in rural Georgia and not grow up watching wrestling and obviously hunting and fishing. And so, you know, it's funny, through my life and the opportunity I've had to work in this hunting industry, there's two major things, now three, that my fans and my kinfolk, you know, they think I become a celebrity by doing. One was, I had a chance to work with Waffle House on their menu one time because obviously they serve up a bunch of hunters when it comes to breakfast. And so my family thought that was cool. And then I thought the highlight was when I had a chance to hang out and meet Shawn Michaels. But now that I've been on the Stone Cold Steve Austin show, my friends and family finally believe that I've made it in this world. So that's pretty good. So thank you for having me on, at least at the family reunion. I know they're going to be high-fiving me, man. So that's cool. But when it comes to hunting, man, it's just like you was talking about how you grew up there and moved to Victoria. In my family, man, everybody hunted and fished. And it wasn't about just seeing what you could go out and shoot. It was because you lived on a lot of it for substances and you needed it. And, you know, grew up, I wouldn't say poor, but definitely lower middle class, to where everybody worked and everybody hunted from time to time. And, you know, go to God's renewable resource there to the grocery store in the wild to make sure you had a little bit of venison for table fare. And not only did you do that, you had a chance to spend a lot of time with your family trying to obtain that prime time ground round, for lack of better words. And so with that, hunting was just always a big part of my life, and never realized you could make a living promoting, you know, hunting and fishing. And so it's been unbelievable, man. I've had a chance to hook up and meet a lot of different people out there. But at the end of it, you just meet people who truly understand what hunting is all about. You know, we all got to eat. We all got to go to the grocery store. There's all kind of different peoples in this world. And most of us, I say, are carnivores. We like to eat whether it be a Big Mac or a pizza with some pepperoni on it, or maybe some brisket or some pulled pork if you're down there in Texas. And when you understand and grow up with a father like yours and mine that introduces you to it, you realize that if times get tough, you know, we can be organic. We can be, you know, in this world, how it's gotten real green, we can still go to the wild, and we got these renewable resources out there that we can, you know, provide for not only us, but for our family. So it's been a really cool blessing, man. It really has.
Hey, what did you grow up hunting? Is it squirrels, rabbits? I know you're big into the turkeys. I want to talk about turkeys in a little bit because it is turkey season, but I know you had to do some deer hunting, but what was your basic thing that you pursued way back in the day?
Well, it's funny. I had an old pawpaw. He had an old 57 Chevrolet pickup truck, and, he grew up farming, always made a little shine liquor, and literally, I remember the chief of police, old black guy, used to come down and buy shine liquor for my pawpaw, and I didn't know what he was doing. Matter of fact, one day, Steve, I went down to my pawpaw's house, and this guy was country. Overalls, had an old Dexter tractor. Even when I was little, I remember he had a few mules. He had a mule he still plowed with a little single plow stock. I always had, you know, tomatoes and squash and okra and you know, pink-eyed purple hull peas he grew. And so he was country, but he always made old moonshine back there, and he would sell it. And one day, I'd never forget, I must have been 9 years old. I come down there, and there was a few old guys laying out under a man and a woman. They was actually two men and a lady. They laid under a big old Georgia pine, and they had white T-shirts on, and they had blood all down their T-shirt. And so I took off running, freaking out, and I run down there, and I said, "Papa," and old Papa Waddell was down there, had his overalls, shelling some butter beans. I remember it like yesterday. And I said, "Papa, somebody's been shot up there in your front yard. They passed out under the tree. I don't know if they've been shot or what." And he said, no, he stuttered real bad. He said, no, they ain't been shot. He said, "They drunk on that shine liquor. I've been had them weed eat all day." He'd been trading out that shine liquor to get them to weed eat down there around the pond. And so, you know, I grew up, and then, you know, later that day, he threw me in the truck and we went fishing and checked a trot line and caught a few channel cat. He used to eat snapping turtles and stuff. And so he grew up just like you see a lot of these folks on TV now, whether it be the Robertson family or, you know, or those guys on Swamp People. And so that was kind of the way I lived. And I started with probably squirrel, rabbit, and things like that. And I never started hunting for the sport of it. I started because I wanted to be part of that brotherhood of men who went out to try to provide some victuals for that night's meal that went along with the mashed potatoes, that went along with those butter beans he was shelling. And so it just grew, and it grew into a passion. It grew into where it got real scientific, as I wanted to figure out how to better myself and to be, you know, more of an asset to myself and my family when it come to hunting down these animals and these wild animals. And it become a challenge. And I realized it was a lot harder to chase down an old booger bottom Georgia whitetail than it would be to go to the meat department, you know, and buy some round steak or maybe a can of Vienna sausage. So I started realizing at a young age, you know, where this food came from. And I realized that turkey breast didn't grow beside a pear. You know, it didn't grow beside an apple or a squash. Right. So it just started from there, and it just led to every game and every different species around the world that I've tried to pursue and look into and understand more about the culture around it.
Did you ever retain that shine recipe that Papa was making?
You know what? I did. And I'm even scared to say that, because I know you are worldwide. But yeah, if you're going to know how to hunt and fish and beef and booger bottom, you still got to know how to make moonshine and corn liquor. You got to.
Dude, every time I go to Georgia to film one of my shows for CMT, I'll get about three or four mason jars of shine, different kind of shine, passed to me. And I really enjoy it. So you might have to pass that recipe on to me one of these days.
It's redneck breakdancing fluids, what I call it. But I'm telling you, you can be country as chicken coop, and you drank a little swig of that a few times, and get you one of them broken skull beers to chase it down with, and you will be boon walking, son. You will be Michael Jackson, I can tell you.
Talk about how you got into the hunting industry, because you got into a lot of notoriety for your turkey calling skills, and
I got started through that.
Well, yeah, man, here's my one of my turkey hunting stories. I was over in Georgia. I was working for WCW, and my neighbor was a turkey hunter, and I basically just grew up hunting deer and dove hunting. So that's what we did. And so, man, a guy turned me on to turkey hunting, and he, you know, showed me how to use a diaphragm. So, Michael, explain to my audience what a diaphragm collar is that you put in your mouth. You could probably explain it better than I can.
Well, I even got a few laying around in case we need to kind of demonstrate a few.
I was going to get you to do that. But explain what one is.
Well, basically, the diaphragm call is a call that you put in your mouth. And it was basically started by using a leaf. The Indians used different styles or different kinds of leaves that grew on trees, and they could put it in their mouth, in the roof of their mouth, and, you know, force air between their tongue and this leaf and blow air out, and you can make basically the sound of a wild turkey. Obviously, they could make a lot of different sounds, because obviously, if you look at that Native American culture and even our first settlers, they depended a lot on these renewable resources. And so that actually evolved just like technology and anything else from, you know, you got the mud hut, the grass hut, then you got the stick hut, and then next thing you know, you got the high-rise building. But same kind of goes with the diaphragm turkey call. So now it's basically a piece of aluminum. It's got different reeds in it, and it's basically made out of the same material that condom rubber is made with. And it's layered calls. They got different cuts. And by the way you push air across your tongue in between these reeds, it can give some of the most realistic sounds, and actually sound just as good or even better in some cases than a wild turkey. And people spend a lot of time mastering it, no different than a guitar or, you know, or playing a jazz trumpet or whatever. And so, it become an art, and that's kind of how I got started. I've become obsessed with turkey hunting, and I really wanted to get good at turkey calling and understand more about that language, because these turkeys have a true, very, you know, interesting language that they use to communicate, male and female, all the way down to the poults and the young turkeys. And so, man, I was just intrigued by that. And obviously somebody's always trying to put one on a dinner table. The better you could call, the better you could communicate, the better chance you had for success. And so, that's what I did. And I ended up getting to where I would call in turkey competitions and started winning pretty good. And I had a chance to team up with a friend of mine named Ricky Joe Bishop. And they had a two-man team world championship. They had a two-man team grand national championship. And we had a chance to win those competitions a couple of times. And then I had a chance to win the Grand America Turkey Calling Championship. And so from there, I had a chance to start meeting people like Bill Jordan, who owned Realtree Camouflage. And I started guiding for him and, you know, started meeting all kind of cool people, from celebrities to just people within this hunting space that that were businessmen and had product out there. And it just started realizing to me then that, wow, this is such a cool place to be in and a cool industry to be in.
Well, and going back to that that diaphragm turkey call, it's kind of a, I guess you would say, it's almost a semicircle with a flat edge on the back where those reeds are, or those cuts are, and it fits in the roof of your mouth. If you listen to the show and you put your tongue into the roof of your mouth, that's where that diaphragm fits. So, you know, my buddy turned me on to the diaphragm call. I'm out there practicing, trying to get good. I would have been special education level. So I wasn't very proficient with the diaphragm call. And I remember I started hacking or coughing one time, and I inhaled and I almost swallowed that god dang diaphragm call. I started choking on that thing, Michael. And it got so bad, I thought I was going to die. And it'd been something if I'd have choked to death on a damn diaphragm turkey call. And I said, well, you know what? I was stunning Steve back in. I said, how did old stunning Steve die? He goes, well, he was out there turkey calling. He choked on a diaphragm. And the bad news was that he died. The good news was while he was dying, he called up 15 gobblers.
That would have been it. That would have been, you'd have been on the cover of every wrestling magazine and Outdoor Life. Stunning Stone Cold Steve Austin.
So you hook up with Bill Jordan, and then you start getting on a TV shows. Were you just guided at first? Because, I mean, you're kind of a jack of all trades. Did you learn editing and producing and all of that under his guise? You picked that all up? Because here's the thing about you. You're no college degree. You graduated from high school, I'm assuming.
Right. Barely,
and so but everything, all your hunting skills, self-taught, and then Bill Jordan, was he able to help you out with the business dynamic of doing what you do now?
He did, and I did. I started as a guide, and they had a bunch of outdoor writers come in, and they had me come guide. And the reason I had that opportunity is because I had a couple titles. And so they could say, hey, man, I was 20 years old. You know, this young kid, he just won the world championship, and, you know, he'll take you hunting, and he'll get you a turkey. And of course, they were giving me at the time $100 a day and free camouflage, and I had free turkey calls. So in my mind, I had already made it big time. I mean, I'm like, there's nobody out there that's richer than me, because I'm like, you know, this is all you need in life, free turkey calls and camo, and have a chance to make $100 a day hunting. And so from there, Realtree was growing. And back in the day, there was a bunch of TV shows that they had on a Sunday night that was on TNN, the Nashville network. And so they had Realtree Outdoors, and I think Jackie Bushman had a show, a couple other people.
Yeah.
And so they were growing, and they said, hey, man, do you think you could run a camera? And I said, well, I don't know much about it other than, you know, I've videoed some of our stuff and some of the hunts I've been on around my house in Georgia. And they said, well, here's this camera. And it was an old Betacam. You probably remember them old Betacam,
yeah.
Big clunky cameras, and they were huge. And at the time, you know, I was young and pretty good shape, so I felt like I could walk around with these big cameras pretty good. And so I immediately took that camera out and started videoing stuff. And from there, I started videoing some of these hunters that Bill Jordan and David Blanton would get me to guide. And they started paying me actually just to run a camera. So it went from a guide to a cameraman, but I would still go out there and yelp and call. And so that same year, the first year I had a chance to start working, I had a chance to start hunting and videoing with Bill Jordan and videoing all of his hunts. And all those hunts were going on TNN. So I didn't know anything about it, but I slowly started learning more about the TV process, the editing part of it, you know, how to shoot stuff, how to shoot an interview, a little bit more of the technical aspects of it. They even sent me to school in Rockport, Maine for a week just to learn how to edit on nonlinear stuff. A lot of that's, you know, I've forgotten about now, but back in the day, you know, it meant a lot, and they offered me a full-time job. And, And so that was back in around 93, 94, and the rest has been history. And really, it's just been an open door, and the sky's been the limit as to what you can kind of go after. So it's been a really interesting ride for sure.
Well, when was it then Bill said, hey, man, this kid calls a hell of a turkey, runs a camera, but he's also got the gift of gab. He's got some charisma, good-looking young guy, and decided to put you in front of the camera as an on-air personality.
That was the most amazing part, because I was really happy. I was making a living. I was having a chance to hunt with, you know, heroes of mine. I remember Dale Earnhardt would come down Steve. And I was such a fan, just like I am of you and so many others out there in this industry and just the world. And I couldn't believe it, you know. And this guy come down, and he said, I want to hunt with that young kid right there. I heard he's a world champion. And so immediately me and Dale go out there, start hunting turkeys.
Dude, how cool is that, hunting with Dale Earnhardt?
It was unbelievable. And as you know, as a 20-year-old kid, you're riding around in a pickup truck, and you got the old Intimidator sitting beside you, and you pull up at a red light in Alabama, you know, over in Salem, Alabama, and you got a redneck with Earnhardt sticker sitting in there on a beat-up old Chevrolet ST, and he looks over, and there's Earnhardt, and he waves at him. It was like Jesus Christ was riding around with you. I mean, that was the same. And people would freak out. They'd run off the road and try to run us down to get Dale to sign something, and it was amazing. And for me, I was like a little youngin' in a candy store. I couldn't believe it. And to see him get a turkey and then every year come back and say, hey, man, I want to hump that Waddell kid. And so from there, just so many crazy things happened. But what I remember was when I would get a chance to hunt, especially with the true personalities, and one thing that's apparent, and I listen to a lot of your podcasts, when you got different personalities, whether it's the wrestlers or different celebrities, if that's what you want to call them, but in reality, celebrity is probably a shallow word to use, their personalities, because what happens is they're very secure with who they are. In other words, they don't mind saying what they want to say. They laugh and they cut up. They don't take advantage of today because they laugh and cut up and want to have fun. And so usually that's what makes a personality. So the big thing it become apparent to me is a lot of these country singers, rock and roll guys, actors, actresses, wrestlers. I had a chance to hunt with a lot of wrestlers over the years. And so when I saw that, their personality shine through. And so always I had this little old high 8 camera. And as I got to be buddies with these personalities, we would always video just crazy stuff. We'd put the big television cameras up, and then we'd ride around on a high rack in Texas, and we would cut up and tell jokes. We'd have people like Mark Chestnut and Hank Williams Jr. They'd be playing the guitar, singing songs that nobody has heard, and be around a campfire laughing and cutting up. So when I would come home from a trip, they would nothing that would be incriminating, but I would show my friends. I was like, you want to see what Mark Chestnut is really like? Check this home video out. And they would laugh immediately. They would go and they'd buy all his albums. And it's like, dude, that Chestnut is just like us. This Dale Earnhardt, dude, I loved him before based on what I saw him on racing. But now that I've seen this home video of your video, Michael, I realize he truly is just like us, except he can also drive a car real fast. So immediately I remember taking all that footage and taking it to David Blanton and Bill Jordan and said, guys, this is the true hit that we have, these personalities, not only the celebrities, but these people you meet, the cooks in camp, these different personalities you run into on the road and these different people you run into when you're in Alaska and stuff. And so I said, we ought to make this show kind of behind the scenes. And David Blanton said, we could call it Road Trip or Road Trips. And I said, well, I don't know who you host it, but it ain't going to take somebody special to host it. It just needs somebody that can be secure and have fun. And I remember David Blanton and Bill Jordan said, well, why don't you host it, Michael? And we'll put it on this network called Outdoor Channel. And that was gave me the opportunity to host that Realtree Road Trip. So I never had the goal or dream of being on TV. It just kind of happened. And those doors opened and I had a chance to start doing that. And immediately that recipe kind of hit home. And I bonded some really good friendships with a lot of different celebrities and just your average Joes that just were walking the streets that were great hunters, great funny guys, and kind of the rest is history. And we've kind of used that recipe to kind of show that everybody's really the same. We just all have different talents, but at the end of it, we love to be outdoors and to be secure, to hunt and fish, and just to enjoy our times with our family and friends.
When you saw Dale Earnhardt right before a race, he'd always have those black sunglasses on and never would crack a smile. And like you said, they called him the Intimidator, and he was one of the greatest race car drivers of all time. How was he at the hunting camp? Was he laid back? Was he like to just laugh and joke? Was he a serious guy?
He was. He was really laid back by nature and really liked to laugh. And he had so many little, you know, quirks. I remember one thing about Dale, he would not – I mean, would not, and he would let nobody else in camp drank a beer out of aluminum can because he said that causes cancer. You pour that thing in a Dixie cup. He said you need to drink it out of plastic or a glass. And I never forget that. And the other thing I remember about Dale, he was always kind. He always was a big tipper. He would go to the cooks and always hand them, you know, $200 to $500. And even though I worked at Realtree, I remember forget he would say, you know, hey, take this $200 and go buy yourself something with it. Go buy your family something with it. And I was like, Dale, it's not. I work for Realtree. You're here as our guest. He said, yeah, but you a broke son of a bitch. You need to go buy yourself something. Go. And he was just so kind and generous. But then he was so intense. Like when it come to hunting, I mean, he was insane. He had to get the biggest. He wanted to shoot the biggest. It was like he was running Talladega, you know.
Yeah.
So, but the biggest thing I remember is he was just like, you know, cousins I grew up with in rural Georgia, or maybe somebody you would have grew up with in, you know, Victoria, Texas. Just a laid back old redneck that could drive a car and had a great charisma and was an immense amount of fun. But he was very competitive, you know, overall. But just a super cool guy, man. I mean, it really hurt me when he passed away. I'm telling you, it really took it made me not even want to turn on NASCAR for a little while.
You know, it took the wind out of a lot of people's sails. I mean, because that guy, he was a guy that crossed over. First of all, he was the biggest star in NASCAR, but I mean, he crossed over in the mainstream. So even if you didn't watch NASCAR, you knew who Dale Earnhardt was.
Oh, you did. And I'll tell you a story, Steve, that's an amazing. And I hadn't told this story much outside of the hunting industry, but Dale was always a Remington firearms guy. He loved Remington rifles. He worked with them on the side of his car, along with Richard Childress and stuff. And so at the time, Thompson Center had come out with these new, really technology-driven muzzleloaders. And so I had one. I bought one through my contacts at Realtree. I'm videoing Dale in Iowa, and it was the year before this crash. And he had this old shotgun. And well, anyway, he didn't have a good scope on it, and we couldn't get it to zeroed in. I said, Dale, just take my Thompson Center. He said, man, I'm not shooting that Thompson Center. You can just put it up. Long story short, I went out. He shot and missed two different deer with this Remington gun, not because of the shotgun, but because
he couldn't get it dialed in,
had a bad scope. So he had to leave and do a big appearance for NASCAR. And he was coming back to hunt with our friends, Don Kiske. And I left my gun with Don Kiske. And I told Dale, I said, Dale, if you get a chance to come back, you're only going to have 2 days to hunt. Please take my gun. And this is taboo in our industry, but even if you have to shoot cutaways, as we would call it, with that Remington, my gun is dialed on, man. I paid my money with it. I made sure it sighted in. 150 grains of Pyrodex powder with this 250 grain Sabot. You're going to be successful. Well, needless to say, I said, but look, if you use my gun and you shoot it, make sure you clean it. Take these swabs and this gun cleaning product and clean that gun for me. I'll do it, Waddell. Don't worry about it. But I ain't going to shoot it no way. But if I do, I'll clean it. Long story short, he goes out. He shoots this deer, big Iowa buck, his last buck on video. And he shoots it and he uses my gun. So Don Kiske goes, man, Dale, use your gun. I said, awesome. I said, you remember him cleaning it? He said, no, I don't know. He said he took it with him on his plane, on his jet. And I said, okay. So immediately I start calling Dale. And this is right before, this is into December, getting close to the Daytona race. I'm calling him all the time, Steve. I'm like, man, Dale, send my gun back, you know, send my gun. I mean, and all I knew was I was still this broke cameraman that was trying to guide a little bit for Realtree that needed my Thompson Center gun back. I didn't pay $400 for this thing. I wanted it back. And so I never could get in touch with him. I mean, he just wouldn't call me back. So needless to say, I finally got in touch with his secretary. She said, Michael, let me run Dale down. I'll see if I can't get you your gun back. She called me back about 3 or 4 days. She says, Michael, she called David Blanton and let him know. Said, look, I got your gun. Dale finally got it back, and he's sending it back. And don't you know, this gun came exactly a week before the Daytona race. So all the way from December to February, I've been working to get this gun back. It comes back. I open the box. And you couldn't have poured mortar mix. I mean, sacrete concrete. It was just, he never cleaned that gun. It was nasty and dirty. And it was one of the last shots he ever killed a deer with. And I was so mad at Dale. I told Kerry Earnhardt about this. I was so mad. I went into David Blanton's office in Realtree's, Bill Jordan. I said, I am mad. I said, he's got more money than anything. And I said, he can't even take care of my gun. And I was so mad. Needless to say, that fateful day in Daytona, he got killed in that wreck. And to this day, I got it in my gun safe. It's one of the last deer Dale ever killed. And that mortar mix is that last shot that he took that buck. And so that's something that's so special to me now. What turned into something I was mad about because he blew my gun. I can tell my kids, and now I got kids and my wife, about this story. And so I don't think it was his last year. I think he went on to get him a buck somewhere in Texas, but that's a cool deal for me that the Waddell family always have, that old gun. And not only that, Steve, he had lost one of the screws, so he took some duct tape and just taped my forearm back on my gun. I mean, he basically ruined it. It was like it was a rental car or something, you know. It's a pretty cool story about Dale Earnhardt.
Hey, I got a chance. I was watching YouTube. I was watching some of the Realtree road trips, and it's you guys going down the road, and it was one of the episodes where y'all took your wives with you. It was a great episode. And then in another episode, because it was the first time they had – well, the one had been away from a mall, as the caption would read. There's a little bit of humor there. But there was another episode where you took Blake Shelton out there. And of course, you know, Blake Shelton's blown up real big right now. He's right. Everywhere. But back in, he was still cutting his teeth and coming on up. And boy, I tell you what, I got a good dose of him. That guy's hilarious. Ended up taking a buck in Kansas. I think you had hunted a stand for 4 or 5 days. It was your usual protocol. You'd, you know, hunt for 4 or 5 days and then someone else to take that stand. And as soon as they took that stand, I'll be danged if they didn't shoot something. And here comes a nice buck, and boy, he doesn't go anywhere. He just drops that buck. He rolls over. Yeah, but Blake Shelton looks like he's a hilarious guy to hang around with. What a personality.
He is. He's another one of those guys that's just down to earth, and obviously his personality is what shines through, man. He's goofy. He's funny. He don't really take anything real serious, and he's laughing all the time, and it's funny. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, Blake's done went Hollywood, but he's far from it, man. He'll still be on that old tractor out there, you know, plowing up something and moving some dirt, you know, in his front end loader. And so it's funny, you know, those routes that you make, I don't think it matters where, no matter where life takes you, you always seem to find your way back to those routes. And I think we've all seen that. And old Blake's no different.
Talking about erectile dysfunction can be a real hassle. Usually you got to kayfabe it and say you lost your mojo or you're just not feeling it tonight. But thanks to our friends at Roman, it is easy to talk about ED with a real doctor who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The doctor will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free 2-day shipping. Again, the whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. No awkward visits to the pharmacy or doctor's office. Just for listeners of the Steve Austin Show, go to GetRoman.com/Austin for a free online visit and free 2-day shipping. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and take care of it. One more time, that's GetRoman.com/Austin for your free online medical visit and free 2-day shipping. Check it out.
Pro wrestling fans, listen up. WWE Hall of Famer and one of the greatest to ever step between the ropes, Jerry the King Lawler.
And I don't think we'd have it any other way.
Join the King and his co-host, Sean Reedy, as they get together to reflect on Jerry's legendary career from Memphis to the WWE to just about everywhere else.
Let me ask you one question. Who's the greatest wrestler in the world?
Download new episodes of The Jerry Lawler Show every Friday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. And if you love the show, tell your friends and leave a rating and review.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
I got a neighbor. He's 2.5 miles down the road from me. He's got a 5,000-acre place. He's got some big deer. And I go over there, and he'd say, God dang, Steve, look at that. Look at that buck. He goes, that's a lot of bone up on that head. That's a lot of bone up on that head. And so anyway, an antler, a deer antler, we call them horns. But it's not truly a horn because a horn is like a cow horn. They never drop those, and antlers shed every year. But let's talk about the marketing part, and let's talk about you show the bone collector. But how did you come up with that? Because that's a great gimmick. It's a great name. How did you come up with that, and did you trademark it? What's the story?
Well, I did trademark it, and here's the story on it. So coming out of when I started, basically left and become independent of Realtree, obviously I never left the Realtree family. I still stayed with Bill Jordan. But in order to take advantage of, say, an endorsement or an appearance or basically just have a business, I had to leave full-time employment at Realtree Camouflage. And so one of the first things that companies wanted to do, they wanted to create these Michael Waddell series of products. And again, keep in mind, I've always been a fan of these things in life. Call it NASCAR, call it wrestling, and you're right. You know, Stone Cold, you got Diamond Dallas Page, you got The Rock, you got all these people. And in the NASCAR, you got The Intimidator, and you got these nicknames. And, of course, it seems like everybody in our culture, this this country and simple, call it redneck. You know, we got to have some kind of nickname. And so, you know, I was always saying something about half stupid or goofy on the show, especially after I had some success in the field, you know. And so I never forget, all these companies want to do these Michael Waddell products. And I'm thinking, man, that is so boring. I said, first of all, the man ego has an immense amount of ego. Who wants, you know, necessarily a Michael Waddell gun? You know what I mean? Maybe I could design something and be a signature series. I said, I wish we could call it something cool. And so Thompson Center, I was with Greg Ritz out on the gun range, and we had been working on this gun, on this Triumph frame that they had come up with. And it was going to be a fairly inexpensive frame, but it was delivering some amazing accuracy and just the way it come together and the cleaning of this muzzleloader. And so they was talking about calling it the Michael Waddell edition. I said, man, I wish we could call it something cool. And I said, I don't know what we call it. So I'm shooting this gun. Well, we quickly come up with a dose of powder and a shot that's just really making this gun, this just shooting like crazy. And it's so accurate. And I looked at Greg Ritz. I said, man, I don't know what we call this gun, but it's going to be a bone collector. And when I said that, I said, man, that's what we call it. And he said, yeah, I love it. And so I get on the plane, go home from that trip. And I was so anxious to get to land so I could call Greg. I said, Greg, look, if you don't mind, I'd like to trademark that myself. I still want to call this gun the bone collector, but I'd like to trademark that, and I'd like to potentially do a show. Now, with the word bone collector, a lot of people, especially the anti-hunting community, could look at that as, that's pretty morbid, it's pretty weird, it's pretty different. But from a marketing standpoint of it, it was just a cool name that got people's attention. You know, what is bone collector? I mean, what is this? And so from there, obviously, if you're going to hunt, no matter what you hunt, you got to collect, you got to take something home, harvest, kill, or whatever. But you got to take it home, put it in your truck. And you, as Ted Nugent say, you got to kill it before you grill it. And so with that said, you know, we just kind of took that and run with it and quickly came up with a logo. And it was like the first stab at a logo. That's what we come up with. But that's the story of how Bone Collector got started. It turned into a TV show. It turned into a brand.
Hey, man, let's talk about your TV shows with the Realty Road Trips. That's still going on?
It is. Realtree Road Trips is still going on. I'm actually working with Bill Jordan Steele and David Blanton, all the guys at Realtree. Actually, T-Bone Turner, the kind of the big guy, who actually the heavy one, he's still helping us with road trips. And Nick Munt from South Dakota, right, and Wyoming, he's still helping out too.
Well, hey, tell me about your schedule here, because you're doing a bone collector, you got the Realtree Road Trips, and tell me about how many days it takes to film an episode, because in my world, trying not to film Broken Skull Challenge or Redneck Island, you're usually looking about 2 days per episode, and man, we're getting it out there. So you were telling me before we started talking, I mean, you're looking at about 7 to 10 days per ep.
That's correct.
And, that's a lot of time goes into, what are y'all, 30, 60-minute show?
It's a 30-minute show, and we end up spending anywhere at minimal maybe a 5-day.
Yeah.
But typically we had about 7 to 10 days in field with 2 to 4 cameras in the field, and everything we do when it comes to hunting is in fair chase situations. And so with that, it definitely can become a challenge. And there's sometimes, Steve, we'll go out there and we might spend 7 days and literally come away with nothing but some pretty good jokes and some pretty big campfires and a couple of country music songs that we sang around a campfire and some good foods and a couple of quesadillas that we ate too many of. And so, you know, if the animals ain't moving or the fish ain't biting, and 98% of what we do is completely hunting. And so it makes it tough, but it actually makes it a cool challenge. So when it's all said and done, you know, we're on the road about half the year. We end up creating around 40 to 45 brand new original episodes a year, and all of those episodes rerun as well. So it's a lot of
so how do you go about scheduling your year? Because I know you like to hunt Texas, I know you love Kansas, you're from Georgia, but you go all over the United States. How do you go about booking that? Do you have I've got this big calendar, it's on my wall, it covers 16 and 17, and I write everything I'm doing in there. How do you go about booking and planning your hunts with all these outfitters? I know you've been doing this a while, but so what's the strategy as far as maintaining some kind of logistics from one place to the next?
Well, one is you got to understand what the animals are doing different times of year and what it is you want to hunt. And so we have our immediate group, and then we also have, you know, friends that we meet on the road. You know, prime example is, you know, one of my goals, I've always wanted to do a hunt with you. And so if you say, man, Michael, I'm wide open and I'm busy, man, I'd love to share camp with you, you know, somewhere, but I got this and going on. You say, but you know what? That first week in December, I'm pretty free. I might have a couple of days, and so obviously, what I try to do from there is I'll just kind of get some different names, some different people we think can add some value to the show, and vice versa. We can kind of take them on a cool adventure that they would truly enjoy. And the whole goal is not business, but when we leave, we're going to leave better friends than we were, just business opportunities to kind of highlight what we do on each other's, you know, networks or shows. But I take all that in account, and I might say, well, Steve, if you got the first week in December, as you know, you grew up in Texas, man, that's a heck of a week in Texas. I think I can line it up. I know you only got, you know, 2 or 3 days maybe you can hunt, but we'll come in. You know, me and Nick Munna come in. We'll scout it out. You know, I got a friend over here. There's a couple outfitters over here. So we lay it all out, and then from there we go to, depending on who the guest is, depending on what we're doing, we'll lay it out and put everything into it as far as the travel, the expense, and try to make sure that when we go, that at the end of the day, we try to make sure that camp has such a laid back, fun environment, whether it be you that's hunting there or whether it be a wounded warrior and or just maybe a first time mom who maybe didn't believe in hunting, that we want to take her and her kid hunting for the first time. We want to make it a mini vacation to where it's all exclusive. When you come behind you, the gates are locked and you can relax, you can enjoy yourself, and you can just completely get from it what you want, whether it's bring your family, whether it's bring your kids and your wife. And we just make it like a big family reunion and make it like the hunting trip that we have saved up for all our life to go on. So that's how we approach it. And then we obviously have a couple of really good camera guys that come and document the hunts and the time around the camp. So it's not scripted, and it takes a lot of time. So really we draw from our experience of what we know about different areas of North America and different time frames. It's going to be really good, and different challenges of what people might be wanting our guests. You know, I've talked to Brett Favre a good bit this past year. We was talking about really want to go on a hunt together. Got a couple different people that I've met from Wounded Warriors that really want to go do something. So it all varies. And some people say, man, I want to go on an elk hunt, and I want it to be a challenge. I don't want it to be easy. I want it to be tough. But I want to hunt out of a tent camp. So we'll take that in mind. And then a lot of times it might be just a kid that don't care if he ever even sees a turkey. He just wants to spend time around the camp, and maybe he's got a father that's absent that he just wants somebody to give him some nurture and show him some attention. So there's so many things we take into account, and we lay it out and we put those trips together, buy airplane tickets and do all the details. And I handle all that myself along with a couple people there at the office that helped me kind of with the details of that. So
talk about the pressure of putting something on the ground, and it's got to be the right thing that's on the ground. I was watching one of your episodes, I believe it was Montana. I can't remember the some wagon ranch. It was can't remember the name of it. But anyway, you were hunting elk and you were bow hunting, and boy, y'all would see a couple, but you just couldn't get in range. I think a couple that came in range were just young bulls, and you passed on them. And it was real hot, so the bulls would stop bugling. They were laying down, weren't cooperating, so to speak. So you end up going back with a rifle. So tell me about the pressure of, you know, like you said, sometimes you come back with a couple of jokes and some songs, but, you know, not so much. But, you know, you're trying to get success, but nothing's guaranteed when you're hunting.
Well, and that's exactly right. It's no different than anything else. I mean, it's almost like if we don't come back with a successful show in filling a tag, or providing somebody with a true hunting opportunity they can see unfold on camera, it's almost like having a wrestling match, but nobody wrestles. And so it is pressure. And so with that, what we try to do is we put a lot more pressure on us and our immediate crew to make shots that maybe we don't expect necessarily our guests to make. I mean, you know, if I'm bow hunting, obviously I feel like if that's what I do every day for a living, then if a deer steps out at 50, 60 yards, you know, and I'm working with Bushnell, and they gave me a rangefinder, and I got a Hoyt bow that'll shoot over 300 feet per second, you know, and good broadheads, then I've got to put this deer on the ground when he gives me an opportunity to present a shot. And so, you know, you don't want to hear me make a bunch of excuses, nor does the world. You know, when you was writing your heyday of wrestling, they didn't want to see you trip off the top rope. They want to see Stone Cold Steve Austin give him the stunner, by God, and send him on to the mat and pin him down. And I think that we take that part serious. But it becomes pressure, but we try not to let it affect us, because we know that if we're not having fun doing it, then who in the world is going to want to buy a hunting license? What mom or what kid is going to say, man, I'm not going to go to Six Flags. Instead, I'm going to go down to Victoria, you know, Texas, and I'm going to try to find out where I can go take my kid turkey hunting. So it's kind of a fine line of how you do that to make sure that you're serious about it. And obviously we take a lot of pride and ethics in making sure we can make a good shot, because it's serious when you're trying to put something you know, one of God's renewable resource on your dinner table, you obviously want to be ethical. And it's a pretty serious venture when you do that. But at the same time, we can't continually be screwing up and goofing off and not being successful, because then people's like, man, this is a joke. They're pretty funny, but them boys don't know nothing about hunting. So it's a fine line of what you do and how you do it.
Let's shift gears here, Michael. It's turkey season right now down there in South Texas, probably everywhere, I guess. I would assume, claim to be pretty knowledgeable about the turkey.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I got some true or false questions for you. You ready for these?
I'm ready. I'm nervous, but I'm ready.
We'll get these questions out of the way, and then I want to talk to get you to use your calls or something like that. And like, dude, that one time after I choked on that diaphragm call, I just went to a call box. I never put another diaphragm read in my mouth again. But anyway, here's a couple true false questions for you, Michael, just to see exactly how knowledgeable you are, because I've been doing my research, brother, and I hope you're over. You got a towel to wipe the sweat off your forehead. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, Michael, true or false? The American turkey is a direct descendant of the prehistoric bird, the pterodactyl.
I'd have to say false.
Yeah, that is actually true.
It is.
No, I'm kidding. It's false.
Man, I wouldn't have known that. I was just guessing. At least I got
50-50 chance. Hey, dude, I'm a little bit of a bullshit artist myself. Here we go. In the United States, there are 7 different turkeys.
No, that'd be false.
Correct. Name the 4 turkeys. Or 5, depending.
Actually, there's 5. You want to go down to Mexico. You got your Eastern Wild Turkey. You got your Osceola down in Florida. You got your Rio Grande, which is lives happily and proudly throwing a Texas flag up down there. And that's a Rio Grande in Texas. And of course, across parts of Oklahoma. Then you got your Merriam Turkey, which is your kind of white fan that lives out in the western part of the world. Then, of course, that's the Gould Turkey that lives in Mexico that speaks Spanish.
You are correct, sir. All right. True or false? Turkeys are the only bird that is able to outrun an ostrich.
Huh. That was say, I was wondering, I thought you was going to say a turkey is the only animal that presents the poacher the opportunity to outrun the game warden if caught across the property line. But I would say true. I would think a turkey could just about outrun a turkey and come close to it.
I just made that one up. There ain't no way a turkey go outrun an ostrich and them long ass legs.
It's kind of like Edwin Moses of the turkey.
I'm going to give you a fail on that one. Edwin, I'm going to give you a chance to redeem yourself. Don't feel bad. Turkeys are carnivorous birds, but will eat grass to survive if they have to.
That is true.
It is?
I would say a turkey will definitely eat a lizard. They'll eat a snake, but a turkey will eat anything. Look here, I know a lot of country folks don't eat a turkey or a chicken because they know they'll eat absolutely about anything. I wouldn't say they're carnivorous to the point where they're going to sit there and eat roast beef. But let me tell you something. You let a grasshopper, you let a ladybug or cricket, or you let anything out there that's crawling, even little small snakes, they will eat them. So I don't know if that makes them carnivorous, but I know they're animals that will eat on opportunity.
Well, hell, I just made up a BS question, but you gave a damn good answer. I wasn't even taking that into consideration because I didn't exactly know what they ate. So all right, you're going to pass the test on that one. I got a few more here, Michael.
All right.
Each year, turkeys migrate and fly south in a V formation to South Beach to avoid cold weather.
That would be false.
All right, 2 more. Domestic turkeys can be house trained and learn to speak just like a parrot.
That would be incorrect. That's false.
Michael, you could have said that was just straight up BS. Here's one for you, last one. In 2002, on Thanksgiving Day, there was a shortage in the United States of butterball turkeys because a new employee had forgotten to butter the balls.
That's got to be true. If you ain't buttering them balls, son, you ain't living in life. I know it's a family show.
All right, Michael, here's the thing. Down at the Broken Skull Ranch in South Texas, I got the Nueces River as my southern border. One time I was out on a deer stand right down by that river, and literally I stopped counting. The corn feeder went off, and these turkeys just come out of the roost and got down on the ground, started walking down the road. I got my place mowed up pretty good. I stopped counting at 150 birds. It was one of the coolest, and that's a true story, damnedest things I'd ever seen in my life. Just that sun was coming up and just kind of shimmering on the backs and shoulders of those birds as they walked towards that corn feeder. They ate up my corn in about 5 minutes and then just kept walking on down the road. And then we had a big flood come in right before the drought hit, and everything down there was flooded, and it just ran them turkeys off, and my ranch ain't been the same since. So if you were to come out to the Broken Skull Ranch, and I would just say, hey, Michael, I'm turning you loose. Here's 2,000 acres. It's shaped like a rectangle. How are you going to go out there? What's going to be your approach to set up on a piece of land that you've never been on?
Well, one is what you just described, too, is Mother Nature's Fury. I mean, a lot of people think it's, you know, the hunters that take wildlife out, but Mother Nature has a sure enough fierce way to deal with nature deal with the wildlife. And as you just talked about, turkeys need water, but they don't need that much water. And when you have that much water comes in, it completely just tears down all their nesting habitat and takes down so much. So even though those turkeys that are living there will make it through it, it decimates the next year's poult hatch. And so that's one reason you'll have to recover after a big time, you know, flood like that. But the number one thing I would do, every terrain offers a little different situation. In Texas, in your part of the country, where sometimes certain areas of Texas, the trees are sparse, you got to find those rivers and those big creek bottoms where those either bigger mesquite or live oaks. That's where all the turkeys always going to roost. And so, number one, you can eliminate a lot of that low-lying stuff where turkeys are going to start, you know, at daylight. And a good thing about a turkey, they're going to go to roost, and it's just a matter of establishing, you know, where you can hear that turkey on roost. So in a place like yours, I would imagine you got a lot of mesquite flat and different areas, and then along those river bottoms, you got some pretty big live oak trees. So all your turkeys are going to be down there in those bigger live oak trees when it cracks daylight. And so from that, you know, obviously during the springtime, you can manipulate a turkey because he is hungry and he's sexually frustrated. He has one time a year that he can breed. And so he's listening to every little sound that a hen turkey makes. He's listening to the other males, the other mall studs or bar goers that's around there trying to, you know, breed these hens. And a turkey is just the ultimate, for lack of better words, peckerhead guy who is trying to breed everything. And here's something brutal about the turkeys. Most of the time, if you see, and I'm sure you've seen this spring here, you might see two or three gobblers strutting together. And they're courting, let's just say, five or six hens. Well, most of the time, they're out of the same brood, and they'll be brothers. They'll definitely be kin. Most of the time, if one of those turkeys trip, fall, or get shot and start flopping, which that flopping means they're wounded, they're hurt, the other two turkeys will immediately, they don't call 911, they don't immediately start giving mouth to meth. They will sit there and peck the eyeballs out of their brother to make sure that just gives them all those five turkeys to breed, or maybe it's a little bit more around the corn feeder. And so it's one thing to realize Mother Nature is pretty darn brutal. So when you realize that, you first have to get past, you know, the polar bear commercials where these polar bears are loving up on each other and realize that you're dealing with something that is very opportunistic. They're very selfish in their desires to eat, to breed. And so when you take that in mind and you're trying to put one of these true wild organic turkeys on your Thanksgiving table, then you got to realize that you have to be very sexual in your calling because you're manipulating something that means a lot to him. He wakes up and he is fired up. He's ready to come in. He doesn't have to be loyal to any wife or girlfriend. He has to not be honored to any father or mother. He is trying to breed everything. And so when you do that, you're going to use everything you can and also what he thinks he wants to go in a direction he thinks is safe. In that case, based on what you just said, those senderos out in Texas, they like to walk those senderos. They know where food sources are, like these corn feeders or maybe food plots. So you want to think that when a turkey's gobbling, you want to put yourself in between him and those food sources and obviously give him a little bit of incentive and some sexy talk. And so many times you can manipulate that.
Tell me about the turkey going up to roost. Just because, like I said, dude, I've been probably turkey hunting three or four times, but after watching so many videos on YouTube, it's something I'm going to get into a lot more than I have been. It just seems like I've always got a show in production or whatever, but enough excuses about that. But so why does the turkey at nighttime go up to roost? Is that just for safety's sake, to get off the ground?
It is. It's just like any kind of chicken or whatever. They like to get off the ground. They're, you know, a turkey is a preyed upon item from, you know, coyotes, bobcats, and obviously Texas has a lot of predators, but all across this country it does. Same with chickens and different other, you know, poultry type, you know, birds or whatever. And so they fly up, not number one, out of habit, but also mainly for safety, the turkeys will. And so they can go up there, they roost, and they can sleep basically in the trees, and they're basically protected from anything that would want to come after them. Now, keep in mind, the flip side of that, when these hens get bred, they have to nest on the ground. They have to stay on that nest. So that's when these turkeys are most vulnerable, when they're nesting. And you got all these other nest predators like coons, raccoons, bobcats, and coyotes. Now they've got the opportunity to come and not necessarily try to eat that hen, but to eat that nest of eggs, you know, from chickens, snakes, to you name it. There's a lot of different things that are after that same resource.
So if you get out there and you get you set up, are you going to start with a locator call to try to get a response, or what's going to be your start?
Well, yeah, you do a lot of times. You know, in Texas, it's cool because turkeys gobble a lot, and say in Texas, but across North America and different species you might hunt, yeah, they are something you can get fired up with different other animal noises, like a barred owl or crow. A lot of times in the morning, I'll just give one single hoot from a barred owl. It might sound like this. Ooh. Or you might say, ooh, 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 ooh. And a lot of times when they hear that, they're very territorial. So it's no different than us being out there, go off our front porch to take a leak, and we're just cracking our eyes open and not even got our coffee. And all of a sudden, some dudes or something's yelling at us like, hey.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be like, hey, boy, we're going to holler back. Like, what you doing? And so it's a territorial thing. They're so geared up. They're so sexually charged that any loud noise, they're going to immediately gobble at. It's called a shot gobble. And so from there, you'll understand where they're at. And then you can go in and sit within 100 yards a lot of times and start at that point using your hen call, because that's the female. And you're trying to get this gobbler to reverse nature, because you want that gobbler to leave prospective hens to come to this promise, you know, that is so much better, which obviously, if you think about it, it gets us men in a lot of trouble too. You know, you got where we're supposed to be, and you got what sounds like we should be. And so guess what? Typically, in most cases, that's when you get, you know, popped right upside your head. That's what happens a lot of times in the turkey woods. But it's really hard to reverse that nature, because so many times these gobblers, they gobble, and they're just sitting there, and they're gobbling, and they're attracting hens. The hens are called, the gobbler gobbles, the hen goes to them to be bred. So it's a pretty chauvinistic world that these turkeys live in. So it's really cool to be able to use a hen call. And that's why I think every woman alive should turkey hunt, because it proves that the woman holds the key to the man, and they're in control when it gets down to it. Even though in some situations, the good Lord made it to where this man becomes this big dog, especially in nature. But when you can sit there and you can reverse nature and make this turkey come strutting in to the unknown, that's when you understand the power of the ladies.
So tell me about the different sounds that the turkeys make. Because, you know, just looking at the computer, I got yelps, clucks, cuts, cackles, purrs, a gobble, a spitting and drumming, a putt, a kiki run. I was watching, some of the turkey calling contest on YouTube, and it's just amazing to watch these guys on stage, and the judge will call out the call, and he'll go through it. So, you know, what's the psychology and the strategy behind what sounds you choose to make when you're trying to bring in that gobbler?
Well, the springtime of year is when the romance starts, and that's when the breeding is. So there's a whole different type of language you're going to use during the spring than you would, let's just say, if you hunt turkeys in the fall. But you have a lot of basic fundamental phrases and things that are said that are throughout the year. But for the spring of the year, you know, there's only a handful of calls that sometimes you need to use to manipulate that turkey to gobble or to prove to them that you basically are looking for a sexual encounter. And so it's a very complex language. There are so many different sounds that a hen turkey will make. And there's a whole nother vocabulary of the male turkey or the gobbler. But for the most part, you know, a hunter or somebody seeking to basically hunt a turkey just really needs to learn to master certain calls in the hen vocabulary. You got a cluck, which is a basic sounding note. And I got a call. I'll demonstrate some of that. And then you got your yelping of a hen. And then the cool thing is, just like anything else, you can learn to put different inflections and different excitement in it based on what you're trying to tell that gobbler. There's a difference if your wife says, honey, come to bed, it's getting late. Big difference than if your wife says, honey, and Lord, I hate to even try to, you know, mimic that, but if your honey says, honey, really, come on to bed right now, I promise you, yeah, you're going to be excited if you come to bed right now. So immediately, you know, one is like, oh, she's ready to watch her favorite episode of Nashville and go on and get to sleep, and that's it. And the other one is, baby, TV ain't on, but I'm turned on, come to bed. And so obviously there's different ways you can check a gobbler's temperature by what you say, the way you inflect it. So you can say the same thing, but it's a different inflection.
So give me a couple of sounds over there that you would use to get that gobbler's attention, and tell me what you're doing.
So here's your basic clucks and yelps that you might would use. A cluck being a simple call that a hen uses just to kind of let other turkeys know they're in the area, and they do it involuntary sometimes just as they're walking and feeding. It sounds like this. You hear that sound? Yeah. Just like chickens, you know, they might be in a, you know, in the yard scratching around, clucking, maybe purring. But probably the most common sound that a turkey will make is your cluck and your yelp. And a yelp is something like this. That's a very simple hen yelp. So a very laid back. That is kind of what's up, how you doing? But let's just say this, Steve. Maybe I make that call and a turkey gobbles. A lot of times the way I respond, or in the wild, the way a hen will respond, she immediately puts a different inflection on it that puts a little bit more yearning. It might sound more like this. So immediately, same call, but a complete different inflection that basically says, I'm ready to go. I'm serious. It could be that she's talking to the other hen turkeys to say, hey, you better get out of my territory. This is my area. This is my home. These are my men. So it becomes really intriguing the more you spend time out there in Mother Nature and you hear this vocabulary, and it makes it really cool. And as you get to talking and you're realizing what they're saying, you can sit there and it's no different than when you first, you know, got that Rosetta Stone and you're trying to talk Spanish down in Mexico. You were sitting here talking a different language that was that's not really, you know, got any books about, that you can sit there and talk to wildlife and actually talk to them and tell them what you want to hear. You can hear what they got to say, and you can bring them in or get closer to them by that communication. And that is really cool. That's pretty intense.
Let's give it up for Geico for supporting the Steve Austin Show for all these years. In just 15 minutes, you can save 15% or more on car insurance. Geico has been offering great rates and great service for over 75 years. And anytime you need help, you can speak to one of their trained specialists 24/7. Go to Geico.com and start saving cash. Extra money in your pocket, it may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up his podcast and ride off in the sunset. Don't forget to rate and review the Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends to check us out. If you want to reach me here on the podcast, or if you watch one of those videos I told you to watch about during the show, send me an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Hey, I got a badass beer, and it's reaching the East Coast, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York. Happy to be there. Broken Skull IPA, the best IPA in America, is finally out on the East Coast from El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find it at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in California. If not, check out elsegundobrewing.com. Hey, don't forget, the King of Attitude Church is still available at Pro Wrestling Tees store. ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin. For all those shirts, along with my Broken Skull Ranch apparel. I'd like to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially Roman, WWE 2K20, Zorro.com, Geico, and BetOnline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. If you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description of this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @SteveAustinBSR. Until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.